And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back again on the Connecting the Dots podcast to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, I thought I would have on an old friend did the show for a good long while, Mr. Tom McDonald. Tom McDonald is the knower of all arcana. He's on the air with us today from his home on the edge of the creepy pine barrens in New Jersey. Here to talk about all manner of arcana. How you doing, Tom?
Okay. How are you, Mark? It's been a long time. I was saying before, it's been a year and a half since you and I have done radio together.
That's right.
It was every night at, 5 o'clock for 2 years or so?
Something like that. Every Tuesday night. You were my Tuesday guy, I think.
I was the Ed McMahon to your Johnny Carson.
That's right. That's right. You'd loosen your tie and have a drink at your elbow and,
Right.
I would tell a joke and you would be the only one that laughed because exactly right. Yes. So I got to know Tom. He was a writer for Pathos, and he was the guy that introduced me to among other things the Catholic history of the tarot.
That's right.
Which
it's
I
gonna
mean,
be on my tombstone, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. But that's the thing is, Tom is the guy that goes out and finds out all of this really arcane stuff that's super interesting. You know, so if you stop him on the street, he's the guy that can sit down and tell you the entire history of the tarot. You should do a history of the Ouija board sometime too.
Except there is no good history of the Ouija board. The tarot was actually, you know. For people tuning in late, I was the editor at large of Games Magazine for 20 years. So I made my living covering all manner of electronic and board games and writing about them and being, you know, I indulged my own history interests by publishing history pieces now and then. And I kind of put those together with a Catholic historian bit I play once in a while.
Okay.
And the history of tarot, which was actually developed out of very logical Catholic symbolism and not the fake history, which was that it was, you know, way back in ancient Egypt and okay. Rosicrucians and Masons and all that. But then it was just a game. It was an early version of, say, a trick-taking game like Bridge. And all the rest of the stuff was made up later. And I wasn't like a pioneer on that. Michael Dummett and some other people had done a lot of the heavy lifting on that. But it was buried in fairly obscure books.
Okay.
But Ouija board has no similar history. Ouija board is just plain old evil. You can't do anything with a Ouija board that would ever end without your soul possessed by Keko demons and you dragged into a pit like someone in the end of a bad movie.
I wonder where it comes from, what the history of it is.
I actually don't know. I actually avoid Ouija. I don't even like to look at them or read them. They actually are quite dangerous.
I wouldn't touch one.
I've done some stuff, a lot of stuff on demons and possession and things like that historically. And you find a lot of them in the 20th century, a lot of the cases that are, you know, a lot of demonic cases aren't demonic, but some of them that are, the entry point was the Ouija board.
Okay.
Because it is an entry point and it's pretty ugly.
Okay.
But
I wouldn't touch it. Part of me wonders if it's sort of like the history of Wicca, if it's really like 50 years old.
Yeah, I think it might have just been made up at some point. I'm sure I could at this moment Google it and find something on Wikipedia that was pseudo-historical. And But I'd have to look at a Ouija board to do it. And I was in, you know, my kids like the Spirit Halloween store, and we go in there, and they had a whole section of Ouija merchandise, and my daughter, you know, it's a line from a TV show called Archer. Do you want demons? Because that's how you get demons.
Right.
Well, you know the I'm looking up the Wikipedia history now, just because now that I said it, I have to. It's saying, I don't believe this for a second. One of the first mentions was China, 1100 AD.
Okay.
That sounds fake. you know, I mean, planchette writing, you know, is a thing that you find in automatic writing. William Butler Yeats was involved with it. William Butler Yeats, the great Irish poet, was a notorious occultist.
Oh, okay.
With, you know, probably one of the greatest poet who ever lived, but a little daft. Well, he was Irish, you know, it comes with the territory.
Well, there it is, yeah. Well, but, you know, one of the things that always interested me as an evangelical before I became a Catholic, one of the things that I began to notice was there was a belief, quite unconscious belief, among evangelicals in what I would call negative sacramentality. So right. The idea that God could use matter in, you know, sacraments, was like, that's ridiculous. God is spiritual. He doesn't use matter. But at the same time, there was this like, you must not touch Ouija boards, right?
Right.
And it was like, so the devil can use that's material right. things, but God can't. The God who made it can't use it. And that really struck me, that strange sort of which, of course, goes back to a kind of a Gnostic streak.
It does. I mean, you know, you see a strong strain of Gnosticism running through Calvinism and that whole and all of its offshoots, of which evangelicalism is the most modern manifestation. You see that hatred of physicality and spirituality, which was very much at the time reactive to what had perhaps become an overemphasis on physicality in medieval popular piety, mm-hmm. which is another one of my subjects because it also intersects with the odd. Because, you know, medieval popular practices could be strange because they mixed with folk custom. They were heavily regionalized. It's a very fruitful area for study.
Yeah.
Because it tells us a lot about ourselves.
Right. Well, and because as well, I mean, there's a way in which the sacramental is easily mistaken for the magical and vice versa.
Well, yeah, I had this whole conversation with my son. He said, what's the difference? It was just 2 days ago, and he's a college student now since we last spoke.
Ooh.
And he said, what's the difference between, you know, magic and a sacrament? Which, you know, we've had this discussion before, but he wanted to hear the discussion again. And I said, well, people who don't know anything about religion, you know, militant secularists and atheists and whatnot, you know, like to conflate these two things, that another man's magic is my religion or vice versa, that, you know, what we consider the Eucharist is just, you know, magic to another believer of another faith. And that's not, you know, words actually have meaning, militant secularists. And one of them is magic and another one is religion. And the meaning of magic, as it's been codified, handed down, and is discussed by folklorists, sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists, and any of the ists that study these things and historians, is manipulation by the user of the material world and by extension the gods, demigods, spirits, and other entities. We are forcing through our will, through ritual, through whatever, on these things.
Right.
Whereas religion is supplication. Mm-hmm. We are submitting to God. We're not pretending in a prayer, or we're not pretending that by wearing a sacramental, you know, may look like a magic charm, may even by the believer be perceived as functioning like a magic charm, and that if I do this and this way, I earn spiritual benefits because of the materiality of it, because I'm doing this, I'm controlling this. But really all it is a sign, you know, an outward mm-hmm. sign of an inward grace, as we say in theology and teaching.
Right.
And we're not manipulating anything. We're making signs. The signs have meaning. The meaning is created by God functioning through the Holy Spirit in our material world, just in the same way the consecration brings the Holy Spirit into play, you know, through supplication.
Right.
We're requesting. We're not ordering.
And we're doing it because we were told to do it by God.
Yeah, I mean, he said, do this, you know. Yeah. God, he didn't say, well, you've got a wart. You should probably get this icon of, let's say, Diana and rub it on a frog and wear it around your neck and then turn around three times and spit through your fingers, you know.
Right.
You know, all kind. This is all fascinating subjects for study. I'm sitting here. I've got my set of reference books in front of me on the desk, and one of them is Opie Tatum's Dictionary of Superstition. And you can flip through and find amazing things people believed and would do. You know, a lot of them having to do with sex, and maybe just as many having to do with warts. But
okay.
Warts was a big problem.
Well, I couldn't say apparently so.
And, you know, it's fascinating. You know, there's a borderline there that can get very fuzzy because if you look at, you know, the charms people used, Milagros, right, to just so you know, I'm losing words now and then. So if I forget something, correct me. People would create little shapes of a wounded part of them. Say if their heart was hurting because of they've lost a love, they might make a heart out of silver or wax. They might make a foot or a hand or a limb or a head if they had headaches, and they would bring these to the shrine. In the Middle Ages, this would be a form of donation so that the material it was made out of might have been wax, it might have been silver. It was a way to give that offering to the shrine for the support of the shrine, and then it would be melted down and, you know, traded so that the shrine could be maintained. It took these shapes in a kind of folkloric way because we had seen these votive offerings in history before. The Romans used them. Romans would craft little hands and feet and arms and legs and heads and penises and other things to get these things functioning, especially penises.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we kind of baptized them and we stripped out the superstitious aspect of it and we kind of bring them down and they're definitely borderline.
Mm-hmm.
But right now they help us, I think, by visualizing. We're a very tactile species, you know. If we need healing, we know that we're praying to God for it, but we want to do something. I remember an interesting anecdote from the actor Robert Downey Jr. When he was in prison. One of the only things they had to do was go to chapel, and he said he's not a Catholic, but he loved going to the Catholics because they had stuff. You got to handle things, cards and beads and cool things you could touch, and that tactility was very important, especially in prison.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I thought it was an interesting observation from him. It didn't make him particularly Catholic, but it speaks to what people like. And when I go down the aisle in my very white bread, middle class neighborhood supermarket, ShopRite, where my son works, and see all of the votive candles with all the exotic saints on them, well, that's kind of a witness there, isn't it? That's the only Christian space in that store. And you ain't going to get it by a sermon. There's, you know. Well,
it really is true. I mean, one of the things that I've always appreciated about the faith is that it provides 1,000 doorways for people who don't think and function like me. You know, I mean, you know, we have a dear friend, she's probably got like a third grade education. She had a stroke, so she suffered brain damage. Very simple soul, you know. Right. I'm not going to be able to handle her. Here, just read this copy of John Henry Newman, right? Not going to really scratch where she itches, you know. But a votive candle with Our Lady on it, that's, she gets that.
Sure.
You know, and I'm like, okay, you know, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And this is an interesting point because I got a lot of criticism once for a piece after my father died, and you and I probably disagree on this, but I don't object to the use of the phrase personal relationship with Jesus. I understand that knowing Jesus better is a good thing, but I know that having grown up as a Catholic and known many, many Catholic men, women, and people of not even high school education, I know that that phrase on Catholic ears is a resounding gong sometimes, and it doesn't fit well. And the piece was about my father, who wouldn't have known any of this deeper relationship with Jesus stuff if it smacked him about the head and neck with a club. He went to Mass every week. He was Holy Name Society. He served the soup kitchen until he was 90.
Hey, respect, you know?
And he was an usher. He was an usher for 70 years, literally. 70 years. And, you know, he raised his kids as Catholics. We said grace at every meal. He said his prayers. He did his thing. And if you said to him, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? It wouldn't have computed. It would have been like, you know, do you argle bargle?
Right. You know, it's jargon. What,
yeah. And it was jargon, and it's a foreign jargon in some cases. And what the point I was trying to make was that the sacraments are efficacious all on their own, whether we grasp them at a, you know, a theological master's level or at a third grade, you know, stroke victim level, you know, or seventh, you know, 7 year old's level, which is our age of reason currently, decided by people who've never met a 7 year old, apparently. but that's when we give usually, first confession or first communion now.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that all of these things, because of Catholic sacramental understanding, work with or without us. And they work with or without a good priesthood. They need the priesthood because anointing also is a permanent sign, as it was in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, you do not kill the Lord's anointed.
Right.
That's a permanent thing. It wasn't just like, oh, he had a promotion and he's now anointed CO or whatever. he's actually, you know, what I had to explain when I taught confirmation was that confirmation leaves an indelible mark, you know, and I would say, you know, like this magic marker here on your soul. It changes you. And they moderns don't get that. We're very Gnostic. We're very separated from the notion of ritual, of physicality, of the function of sacramentality, separate from us saying, I love Jesus. I love Jesus is very important. But if you never say, I love Jesus, you know, or have your altar call and you go to Mass and you're good and you go to confession and you take your sacraments and you follow Christ in that way, you're good.
Yeah.
you're good. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, it's one of the things that I've always appreciated about the faith is those, you know, those thousand doorways for all those other personality types besides people like me.
Right.
And that means a lot, because there, God has, I remember reading a story one time about a priest, I think this is out of the Orthodox Church, some priest who, you know, stopped and he was walking down the road and there was some peasant woman who was, you know, out chasing her turkeys around. And the priest stopped and talked to her for a while and, you know, helped her gather up these turkeys that had gotten loose. And, you know, the monk who was with him said, you know, Why are you wasting time on these ungodly pursuits? And the priest said, you know, this woman's whole life is in those turkeys. That's where she lives, you know? So, you know, of course you help with the turkeys because that's, you know, that's her whole life. And, you know, that's, it's one of the things that I appreciated about, Garrison Keillor tells a story about, you know, his parents who had, you know, they had like, the prayer voice that you used when you were saying grace at dinner and you adopted this certain tone, you know, that you do when you're saying grace. And then as soon as you're done saying grace, then you fall into your, you know, your real voice. Yeah, you know, I got that tractor fixed, you know. And he said, you know, that's how real life actually is. And so it's one of the things that I have appreciated about the faith is that it has that ability to speak to people at, you know, all kinds of, through all kinds of different doorways and levels. Hey, we were going to talk today. You have been doing a little bit of research on something that most people think is a ridiculous legend. but which I...
That's like, you could have said that at any point in the last 20 years. Well, that would have been what I was doing at the moment.
But I think that it's interesting. The legend has grown, which itself is actually a legend. The urban legend has grown up that if you gathered up all the pieces of the true cross, you could build like a Spanish galleon out of it.
Yes, there's true quotes. As Erasmus, even a cargo ship would be too small to transport the numerous fragments of the true cross scattered throughout the world. And there was our old friend Martin Luther. One could build a house using all the parts of the true cross scattered throughout the world. Basically, because anything Erasmus did, Luther did later and worse.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Happy anniversary, Reformation. But I'm not that big a fan of Erasmus either. But that actually isn't true. There's actually an interesting thing. This is actually something that comes along just as you're searching whether the true cross is the true cross or not, and whether we've got a lot of hoo-ha, and whether there's anything. We can talk about that in a minute if you want. But sure. That particular number, a guy named Charles Rouault, and I'm probably saying this wrong, de Fleury, an architect, was kind of fascinated with relics. I think this was maybe in the 19th century. I don't have that in front of me. He estimated that the total volume of the cross, based on various reports. Now, the cross, I believe, was 3 to 4 meters on the vertical and 2 meters on the horizontal. The vertical is called a stipes, mm-hmm. and the horizontal was called a patibulum, if you want. Those are your useless words of the day.
Okay.
So the true cross was 36,000 cubic centimeters on average, if we go by those numbers, and we'll get to where those numbers come from in a minute. But 36,000 cubic centimeters, cc's.
Okay.
And if he cataloged all the pieces of the true cross that were known of at his time, and he came up with 4,000 cubic centimeters, which was less than one-ninth of the volume of the original cross. So that put that one to bed. If anybody says that old saw again, you could say, no, actually, what we're talking about is extremely tiny fragments that get right. spread out and that spread around the world in very bizarre ways.
Including, by the way,
yes,
the altar of my parish church, Blessed Sacrament, has a relic of the true cross in the altar.
Now, what is it? Is it a piece or is it a secondary or tertiary relic?
I think it's a piece of the true cross.
Yeah, well, some of these are very small. I'll tell you where some of them came from. This is why you have me on, because I know these useless things.
Okay.
There were 3 pieces of the true cross. Okay. Well, let's go back. Do you want me? How much time do you have? Do you want the whole thing?
Knock me out. I'm ready.
Knock me out, man. All right. Saint Helena, mother of Constantine, was sent to the Holy Land by Constantine, 325. Okay, this was after the Edict of Milan decriminalized Christianity. There was still – Constantine had been told at that time by Bishop Macarius, the Bishop of Jerusalem at the time of Constantine, that the relics of the crucifixion were hidden somewhere in the city. So St. Helena and her entourage came down there and looked. And there was a cistern near Golgotha, you know, the place of the skull near the crucifixion, which was outside of Jerusalem, where these crosses had been thrown and buried. And they found them and they dug them up. Now, St. Helena's trip to the Holy Land, we have like 7 different people documenting this. Some are dependent on others, you know, beginning with Eusebius, who everybody likes to poo-poo. You and I have talked about Eusebius before, and I believe he's a credible source most of the time. Uh-huh. But there's others who describe Helena's trip. Now, the pious legend was that in this cistern, she found three crosses and three nails. And it was assumed that these were the three crosses of the crucifixion. And in order to determine which one was Christ's cross, she brought a dying woman and touched each one to her, and the one that healed her was the true cross. That is probably pious legend. Ambrose has a much more, St. Ambrose has a much more homely and logical answer for us. Now, Ambrose preached, am I going to remember this? The funeral oration of whomever, I cannot remember who it was. It's a famous funeral oration of, it's leaving me right now, but okay. You find them, look up Ambrose's funeral oration.
Okay.
And this was a generation after Constantine. He says it was very easy for her to identify which one was Christ's cross because the titulus was still attached. Now, the titulus,
really,
the board on which the titulus is far more fascinating than the true cross.
I've seen a photograph of the titulus. It's kept in a church, I think in Spain or something.
Where is it? It's currently, I'm not remembering. It's in Rome, I thought. A piece of cross wound up in. I think all this stuff is. No, the titulus should still be in the Basilica of the Holy Cross, which had been built on top of St. Helena's Palace. You know, so we'll talk. We'll get to the titulus in a second because it's way more interesting than the cross.
Okay.
But Ambrose says that it was very simple because the titulus was still attached to the cross, and that's how she identified it. And Ambrose says this in a very long portion of this funeral oration in which he talks at length about the cross. It's really good. Look it up sometime and just, you know, you'll find it. But he describes how she found that they had he described them as fork-shaped, I remember, which I always thought was rather odd because I don't think of them as fork-shaped. You know, I think of them as cruciform, obviously.
Okay.
But that at that point she divided it into three pieces. The one stayed in Jerusalem, one went to Rome, one went to Constantinople, and the titulus was divided in half between Rome and Jerusalem. The titulus is about half a meter.
Okay.
It was divided in half vertically. Now, all of this splitting of these sacred elements makes anybody who's archaeologically inclined or historically inclined go nuts because they said, this is nuts. Why are these people destroying these sacred artifacts? And was not important. It was not the operating theory was pars pro toto. One part equals the whole. Okay. So that
same with the Eucharist.
Yeah, it was believed to be if it had power, and they believed it did from its proximity to salvation. And there was a very elaborate and theology of this. Ambrose goes into it. A lot of people go into it. The titulus, though, is how we trace the cross. If the titulus is real, then we can decide that the cross pieces are real that trace from the same time, one of these three pieces that was brought by Helena. So it all traces back to how much you believe this story of Helena finding it. When the pious legend was attached, conversely, that sounded better in the Middle Ages of the woman being healed by the cross than the plain truth of the titulus being attached.
Right. You know? That's boring.
Yeah. And nowadays it's the actual opposite. If he said, well, they identified it by a magical healing, that sounds a lot less credible than we identified it because his name was on it.
Right.
So we've still got half of this. Half of this titulus. The other half is long gone. It was left in Jerusalem and taken in one of the many raids over the many years, you know, either by Persians or Muslims or crusaders, and it's just gone.
Okay.
The interesting thing is that the words are still on that. Obviously, just half of them. But here's the most fascinating thing I found on this. Two little fascinating tidbits. First of all, it's in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. We know this. The Titulus is only mentioned, of course, in John, right?
Mm-hmm.
John has the order differently. John has it, if I'm recalling correctly, Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. It's a different order.
Okay.
So if you were forging a Titulus based on the Gospels, I would think you probably would have gotten the order correctly.
Right. Okay.
You know? The other super weird thing is all of the Hebrew, Greek, and Latin reads right to left. Now, Hebrew reads right to left. Greek and Latin read left to right. So whoever wrote it wrote the whole thing right to left.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, and probably it could well have been a native Hebrew speaker.
Sure. Now it was scratched. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was scratched and painted. What they found, we've analyzed it now. In the 1990s, a guy went in and looked at it very carefully, the half that's remaining, and they did some studies. There's not a lot you can do. You can't do, dendrotic studies about the wood because you destroy too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
They found it was a walnut, which actually tallies with pilgrim accounts from the period because I'll get to provenance in a second. That's an extremely important subject and put a pin in that one.
Okay.
But we know from the period that we've heard somebody saying it was made of the wood of a walnut tree, and lo and behold, it's the wood of a walnut tree. So when 20th century science confirms 4th century Pilgrim Chronicle, that's interesting to me.
That is interesting.
It has traces of whitewash in it. There's some traces of whitewash on the board. There's carved letters that have seem to have been etched with a wire and black paint painted inside of them, which is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus in not all of the saying is there, but we see the IS in Greek stands for Jesus. It's the abbreviation. And in Latin, it's just an I, you know, Jesus Nazarene. You know.
Yeah.
The saying. The text was copied, the letters, and sent to independent analysis with paleographers. A paleographer looks at handwriting. Handwriting changes. You know, you can identify all kinds of penmanship and handwriting styles and letter styles. And the different independent analysis came to the conclusion that the Hebrew rates as late Second Temple, which puts it first to third century. So we're good on the Hebrew. The Greek, particularly the weird configuration of the alpha and the omicron epsilon letters, is unique to the first century. And the Latin is less easy to pin down, but it matches Latin from an altar that Pontius Pilate himself actually raised to Tiberius. So it was similar to that inscription, which was found in 1961 in Caesarea.
Hmm.
So the letter formations are correct to their period. If it was a medieval forgery, and we have documents tracing it back to the Middle Ages, that wouldn't have actually been possible. A medieval forger would not have been able to match paleographic evidence to within a century of its making. Am I clear on this one? This is all
comprehensive. Oh, yeah.
We attribute many things to medieval forgery because it's weird that we alternately ascribe complete imbecility and blind superstition and absolute mastery of forging processes and fraud.
That's always been my attitude about the Shroud of Turin. It's like this was done by backwards, gullible suckers, and we still can't reproduce it.
Right.
It's like, if it's a fake, just make another one. It's the 21st century. You know, we've got a lot of science at our fingertips. Just make another one.
Right.
It's got to be easy. I mean, it was made by morons, right?
Right. It's true. And the Titulus is also interesting because I have to tell you, of all things, the True Cross was one I could kind of have skipped. as a viable relic of the Passion, because it seemed like the sketchiest one. I mean, the Turin, Shot of Turin is genuinely damn weird, as we say in history. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the cross would is real. Much harder to trust. What'd you say?
I said that's because it's real. Yeah. I mean, it's always, you know, look.
Yeah, I think it's real. It's not a matter of faith.
This is real. You know, I think it's just the real thing. And I think, you know, carbon dating is not an absolute slammed up hammer lock. It just isn't.
Gosh, no.
You know?
No, and they wouldn't accept, skeptics wouldn't accept, if you had, let's say, 50 pieces of evidence and one that refuted it, the one would be dismissed. They do it all the time.
Right.
You know, and in this case, of the shroud, the carbon thing is the only thing that matches up, and there are, you know, at least a half dozen good reasons why it might fail to match up. They took it from the wrong part. It was stored improperly. It was different. It was bad material. It was exposed to fire and smoke. I mean, carbon dating is not holy writ. Ha ha ha. But the interesting thing is it seems very hard to come up with truth about the cross because it's just a hunk of wood and somebody could have darn well thrown a hunk of wood in there,
right.
You know, with around the time of Helena. So what we are now is we have three possibilities. We have medieval forgery. I think that's out. We have Helena finding a forged one at the time. More possible, not out, but it seems less likely for some of the reasons we just discussed, because we're already 300 years after the fact describing forged letters on the Titulus that were unique to their period. If we're talking about, you know, semi-literate peasants forging crosses and signs, my guess is they wouldn't have done such a hot job of it because they weren't thinking of, you know, skeptics in the 21st century poring over their work. They just wanted the queen to give them some money and go away. Or we've got it's the real thing. Now, the most important thing in art collecting and antiques and documents is called provenance. Provenance is what police would call the chain of custody. If, say, Picasso paints a painting and it shows up, it disappears for 40 years and shows up in a barn, well, its line of provenance has been broken.
Right.
Okay? Because we don't know how it got there. Mm-hmm. If Picasso paints a painting and he sold it to John Q. Schmuck in 1930 and John Q. Schmuck got it stolen by the Gestapo in 1941 and it came out of the Gestapo storage facilities in 1946 at the hands of the U.S. Army. Are you following me here? We know where that painting has come and gone. We've got the chain of custody. We have the provenance. Historical provenance is not always quite that neat, but it does exist. And we have documents that we have to take seriously. I know that's a weird thing that I take eyewitness testimony seriously. You and I have had whole radio shows devoted to eyewitness testimony.
Right.
I know that's just bizarre in the 21st century skeptical line that I believe what people say. But we have, especially when many of them say it,
mm-hmm.
we have Egeria. It was a pilgrim in the 4th century and other pilgrims. Egeria left is one of the most important actual early Christian documents, and it's fairly boring. It's just a list of where she was a pilgrim, and it's a list of places she stopped and what she saw. And in 383, she saw the Titulus in Jerusalem in 383 and describes it, you know, as containing different symbols written by Pilate.
Okay.
And so we know at 383 pilgrims were seeing it. We know, again, it's described again by Antonio di Piacenza. I had to look that one up because I'd forgotten it. In 570, he kissed it. And at the time, he said, it's walnut. That's how when we just tested it later and it was walnut.
Okay.
And in 570, a pilgrim had described it as walnut. And the kissing is an interesting thing, too. By the way, that one disappeared in 614, that Jerusalem Titulus.
Okay.
With the Persians and kind of came back and forth. And it's, you don't need to know all that.
Okay.
One thing about the Titulus and the cross, though, that's described repeatedly is the cross was allowed out for veneration. This is a great one. And when people came up to kiss it for veneration, they would bite off pieces.
That is such fantastic peasant piety.
Isn't it? And they would.
I love that so much.
Secret them in their mouth, and when they got home, they would encase them in gold and wear them around their necks. This okay. became a problem because the true cross starts having bite marks all over. And it's getting smaller. This is one of my favorite things I found in this.
That's awesome.
A special position was created for the custodian of the cross, who stood there to watch to make sure people didn't bite it off. And he was called the Starophylax, which is just such an awesome name. And I don't remember my Greek enough what it means.
Starophylax.
Starophylax. Starophylax.
Well, staro is cross.
Oh, yeah, I know, but I forget what phylax is.
Phylax.
Cross guard.
Could just be cross guard or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so there's where you get your fragments, people.
That's
and you
amazing.
Also get it that we know there's a particular story of St. Terribus, who was in a bishop in Spain. He had been the Starophylax in the 5th century, and he brought a piece back with him to Spain, and it was distributed. So there's a piece in a monastery in Spain, and there's some others elsewhere, small pieces, but we actually have a chain of custody. It was in Jerusalem. It's in Spain. It just showed up in Spain. Some guy saw the limb off a tree and said it was the true cross. No, it was the bishop. Brought it back. We know. There's a document. It tells us. and it was stolen and returned and stolen again. And, you know, a lot of those original pieces just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And the Roman piece was eventually taken by Pope Urban VIII and put in St. Peter's. And he continued to hand out pieces. And we know some of those went to Hungary, some of them went to Poland, some of them went to Cologne, some of them went here. And then from there, more pieces went elsewhere. So it spread and spread and spread. Were any of those pieces of the true cross that show up fake? Undoubtedly some of them are fake.
Sure.
But if we go to the piece, let's say, a Cologne, and we know that Pope Urban III gave that piece to the Bishop of Cologne in 1692, and we know that Pope Urban took his from the Palace of St. Helena, we've already pushed that fragment in Cologne back to the 4th century, so that we're within proximity of the crucifixion. That's comfortable for me, at least, to say that's more likely to be genuine. And it's not the cross, which we can't identify as other than a piece of wood, that tells us that. It's the titulus.
Okay.
Because it accompanied the cross, and Helena found them at the same time.
Interesting.
And that's why, in my mind, the titulus is way more interesting. You can call it up on the internet right now. Just search for it. You'll see it. It's a worn piece of wood. Looks like somebody pried it off a rotting old boat or something.
It doesn't. Given that, I mean, we know that the early church was collecting not merely things associated with the passion, but, you know, they had a positive mania for relics, like, right away. You know, there's a letter from the church at Smyrna that's written just a couple of days after the martyrdom of Polycarp.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you know, well, of course, as soon as his ashes had cooled, we rushed out and collected all of his relics, like you do.
Right.
And it was just like, duh, of course we did this, right? Everybody does this. Right. And, you know, so that tells you a lot about the culture of early Christianity, that this was something that was very interested in preserving, if you will, the memorabilia of the apostles and the passion and all the rest of it. And so it doesn't surprise me at all.
Go ahead. especially things connected to the crucifixion that might have had the precious blood on them. There's a wonderful touch in Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ where the Marys, after, you know, approximately 50 gallons of blood have been sprayed all over the
screen.
Very over the top.
Yeah.
But they get down with their veils and towels and they blot up every one of them. To this, every ounce of it. Because to this day, there are Orthodox Jewish groups in Israel whose job after a bombing is to collect every fragment of blood and flesh that they can find for proper disposal.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it fits, you know. You have to be rational about these things. You can't go off willy-nilly saying, my gosh, it's all real, because there's some relics that, you know, get my Spock eyebrow raised. you know, like the holy tunic. There's a tunic that I'm kind of like, I'm not so good on the tunic. And the veil of Montepello, I'm a little sketchy on that one as well. It's got some interesting bits, and it's also kind of odd to me.
Is this supposed to be Veronica's veil?
Veronica's veil, not the Sudarium. I think the Sudarium is 100% genuine.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I've actually seen like forensics studies of the Sudarium. Sudarium, for those of you who are not familiar with it, the Sudarium is the cloth that was put on the face of Jesus.
Right. Possibly when the reconstruction show, in order to preserve the blood that was released from the head in the deposition from the cross, it would have been under his chin and over his nose and around the back of his head and tied to prevent any blood from being spilled on the ground.
Okay.
And then repositioned and laid on him in the tomb. Go ahead.
Right. Well, anyway, one of the things that I've seen have been very persuasive forensics reconstructions of the relationship of the Sudarium to the Shroud of Turin, that it looks a hell of a lot like. Those claws were, you know, covering the same body. And, you know, sure, it could have been some random guy who just happened to have all the exact wounds described that Jesus is described as having suffered. That might be true, but you know, it's just a whole lot more likely that these are the cloths that covered the body of Jesus Christ. And yeah.
Well, and the blood types match on the Sudarium and the Shroud. It's, They're both the rarest.
It's always AB negative.
AB negative blood. And the patterns match of the spread of the nose and where the blood flow would have been. It's bizarrely persuasive. I was not at all. I was new to it when I first looked at that a few years ago. And I thought, you know, I thought it was another veil of Montepello. And I was like, I'm not.
Yeah.
And then I saw the reconstructions and the fold patterns that allowed the blood to match the shroud. So let's separate them. Let's say they're both forgeries. Okay, let's just go there.
Boy, both is of that them are lucky.
With two separate streams of providence, we're both coming from different places to arrive where they are, yet matching.
Yes.
You know, what we're left with is the only way it's not Jesus is if it's some other poor unlucky guy, like I said.
Yeah. Is,
at that point, don't you just throw up your hands and say, okay.
I mean, I've actually heard people do that, you know, just go, you know, okay, you know, I mean, let's just say that it is, granted, it's 2,000 years old, but we have no proof that this is Jesus. It's like, what will it take, you know?
It's a shifting goalpost. It's a medieval forgery. No, I've just proven it's not. All right, well, then it's a period forgery. And that also seems very unlikely for X, Y, and Z reasons. Exactly. Well, it was some other
It's
guy,
just some other guy who just happens to, you know, yeah. And you go, well, we don't know what he looked like. It's, well, yes, that's true. However, it's oddly coincidental that as, you know, when the Shroud makes it to Constantinople,
right,
that suddenly there becomes a standardized image of what Jesus looked like.
Yeah.
It's used in all, you know, iconographic piety.
Yeah.
Why? What would standardize that image, do you suppose? Besides,
well, there was an actor in Constantinople who played. It was like the Jim Caviezel of the 4th century.
But yeah, I mean, it's that's what's interesting to me is that when the Mother Church of, you know, all the churches of the East acquires the Shroud, suddenly you get a standardized. This is what we're going to make Jesus look like in icons. And before that, you know, Jesus is like you'll see him as a young man without a beard, you know, and because people, there is no physical description ever given of Jesus. But for some reason, the churches in the East suddenly acquire this. This is what he looked like.
Right.
Why would they do that? You know, and so, yeah, I think it's the evidence to me is. So overwhelming, and the only thing against it is a dubious carbon dating, and
right.
It's like, this is real.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty good with the crosses too. I think until I researched the Titulus, I didn't. I wouldn't have gone out on a limb on the crosses that could trace their provenance to Helena. But I think there's enough there. In the paleographic evidence, in the wooden evidence, in everything else that allows us to believe, and we've put to bed the lie that, you know, you would be able to make a ship out of these boards that Erasmus and his plagiarist Martin Luther came up with. It's interesting that they were so invested in these lies too, because we inherit our skepticism, first of all, the belief in a lot of untrue stories, but also our extreme skepticism about these things from the Reformation, from other Christians with their own radical agenda.
Yeah.
You know, much of this is just warmed over Protestant propaganda. I mean, really. I mean, and
right.
So many things are warmed over Reformation propaganda, like, you know, the earth is flat kind of stuff.
Right,
nobody
right.
believed the earth is flat for thousands of years.
Yeah.
You know?
All you got to do is just read Dante. I mean, Dante is living right. in the High Middle Ages. He's perfectly aware that the earth is a ball. I
sure.
mean,
the
divine comedy is the original journey to the center of the earth.
Sure. Right, and there was a center. You know, I mean, they had different ideas about the dome of the sky and what was beyond it, you know, how the spheres moved and, you know, the music of the spheres and all the rest of it.
Right.
But, you know, that's just a refinement. It's not – we're on the back of a giant turtle and it's turtles all the way down.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. We've used up an hour of your time, and that's – I think that's – that's probably enough.
Probably more than enough for most.
But I love having you on because you know all of this arcana, and it's always super interesting. So I want to thank you for being on today, and I want to thank you guys for listening. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots with me, your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back again soon enough to talk about more interesting stuff. Until then, have a wonderful rest of your life, or whenever we see you next. Bye.